History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned, of course, is that they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and, more importantly, to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We aim to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And what we find in that process is that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. On our last episode, we met a Marine from Kansas who was wounded on the first day of the Battle of Iwo Jima, and Jim Friel is celebrating his 100th birthday this weekend in Topeka, so happy birthday, Jim. But because we marked the anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima last weekend, we didn't get to talk about something I generally try to spotlight every year at this time, the annual Day of Remembrance for Americans of Japanese ancestry, observed this time of year because it was on February 19, 1942, that President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, ushering in what we see now as a dark chapter of American history, but a backdrop from which some of World War II's greatest heroism emerged. Day of Remembrance ceremonies were held in many locations last week, pointing back to the 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry who were forced out of their homes and into a very uncertain future in the wake of Imperial Japan's attack on Oahu. And last week also marked the debut of a new documentary film called Unbroken Honor. I have links to the trailer and the entire film for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we're going to hear from the man behind it in a moment. I know you can't technically see it on the radio, but I want you to take a minute to listen, and I think you'll get a taste of what it's all about. Through the film crew's efforts to interview veterans here in the States and also to travel back to where they fought in the war.
We wanted to join the military. It didn't make any difference. They sent us to Japan. They sent us to Europe. We didn't care. The war was against the Axis powers. We want you to volunteer for the 442nd. The answer was, first, let us out of prison. Give us our freedom. We all knew when we volunteer, we're probably not going to come home.
This is a bigger position, fortified rock, and this would have been right at the ridge line, looking over the top of the hill and down the other side. I didn't know we were going to see this kind of stuff.
In a dense spruce forest in the Vosges Mountains of southeastern France, we walk quietly in the footsteps of soldiers, stopping often to allow a cool October breeze to whisper a story of what happened here 78 years ago. We've come to this hallowed ground to better understand, so that we can better explain, how a group of men facing nearly impossible odds fought one of the United States Army's most revered battles in its history.
If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you've probably figured out he's referring to the famed rescue of the Lost Battalion in the Vosges Mountains, the signature achievement of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which we've heard about through the perspectives of rescuer and rescuee over the years on this program. This new documentary, Unbroken Honor, is communicating that incredible story to new audiences all these years later. The film is on YouTube, and I have it linked for you again at hometownheroesradio.com, but we have someone much more qualified to tell you about the film than I am, the man who made the film and even narrated it, Jeff Aiello. And Jeff, I know this is not a quick or simple production, clearly. I'm just curious, how long have you been working on this film that you finally got to premiere last week?
Well, Unbroken Honor, we officially started working on it in 2020. And the first interviews that we did with Lawson Sakai, who's in the film, and with Keith Fudena, I actually shot those two interviews, which make up most of the film as far as the narrative goes. I shot both of those
in 2 days back to back up in the Bay Area back in February of 2020. And then COVID hit. And so that stopped everything. Production on the film stopped at that point for 2 years before I could get up and running again.
Were there ever some days where you're like, I don't know if this is going to happen. I don't know if this is going to come together.
I never doubted it. I always felt strongly about the project. I fell in love with the idea of doing a film on the 442 and the military intelligence service while making Silent Sacrifice, which was the 2-hour film we did in 2017. That had a little hit on it about these two military operations. And while making that film, I'm like, oh my gosh, I really don't know anything about the 442 and less about MIS. And so that's when I went to Elizabeth Laval and PBS at the time, and I said, hey, can we do an expansion documentary based on this storyline? And this was getting made one way or another. I was all chips in.
Well, and you kind of answered my next question a little bit, because obviously the point of this film is to educate people, to open people's eyes to some history they may not be aware of that could repeat itself if we're not vigilant. But I was wondering how much you learned in the process of making this film.
That is the best part of being a documentary filmmaker for me. I did not go to college. I am uneducated. And I went to one semester at Cuesta College in San Luis Obispo. That doesn't count for a whole lot, except that it got me in the television industry. But I love to read and I love to learn. And so when I do a film like this, like Unbroken Honor, I pour myself into it and I read voraciously about it. And I talk to people and I listen to people, more importantly, and had a chance to interview some really knowledgeable people in this space. So for me, I learned everything. I learned so much in doing a film, and I don't even really set out to start making it until I feel like I've got to a certain point of learning, if that makes sense, before I can actually visualize what I think needs to happen.
Well, and hearing the stories is one thing, and our listeners have heard some of these stories, but then seeing it and feeling it is a different thing. When did you decide you were going back to the Vosges Mountains and you were going to walk around there? Because to me, that added something to this film that I don't know a lot of people would have thought of.
For me, that was the most important part of this. And it's funny because I didn't realize that. I wouldn't have realized that had it not been for COVID. And here's what I mean by that. We were on a really tight timeline to get this thing done. And had COVID not happened, we would have made this film without going to France. There was no way, it wasn't an option. And then serendipitously, COVID happens, time happens, you meet people, we have a show that we do called Outside Beyond the Lens, which is a travel show, which has taken me to Europe several times over the course of the last couple of years. And that's when we decided, well, hey, if we're going to go film Outside Beyond the Lens in Switzerland again, which we did, let's just add more to the trip and let's go to those mountains. Here's the thing about that, Paul, that old saying, you don't know what you don't know. I knew I wanted to go there. I knew I wanted to film some town shots of Briere, and that was about it. I just wanted to have that element in it as a storyteller. When we got there and we stayed in Briere for a week, when we got there, that place got in my bones, man. It did. And when we started walking around the battlefields that surround it, hiking Hills D, specifically in Hill 555, and seeing the foxholes, seeing shrapnel still stuck in trees, seeing tank tracks rusted away in the forest litter, there were days when we were walking around filming in there, me and the three guys I was with, David Boomer, Zach Allen, and John Neely, we did not speak to each other. It was somber, it was quiet, and that all soaked in. So when I came home from France, I was a changed person because of that trip. And it changed the way I was going to tell the story from that point on.
And that's one of the things that grabbed me, because a lot of times a filmmaker wants to stay behind the camera and doesn't, very cautious about inserting himself in the story. But by letting us see you in those moss-covered forests shooting that footage, it's almost we feel what it seems like you were feeling in that moment. Have you ever felt something like what you felt there before?
So what you're describing is one of the production techniques that we use quite a bit on Outside Beyond the Lens. And what we say on that show is it's a show about making a travel show. So that's what it is. And so it's all fourth wall breaking. It's all letting the viewer see behind the scenes. One of the big pieces of feedback that we got on Unbroken Honor since it aired, and that we also get in the travel show, is I felt like I was there with you. It was an immersive experience. That is pulled off by the way we do this, by breaking that fourth wall, by seeing myself or John Neely or David, who found the rocks under the tree, the little rocks with the names on it, if you haven't seen the film yet. So it's not that we set out to do it. It's certainly not that, you know, we're all camera hungry. That has nothing to do with it. It's just, to me as a storyteller, I've always felt like if you can see the storyteller in the process of learning about the story, it just brings people to a deeper level. And it's not appropriate every time, and it's not, and I don't use that tactic in everything we do, but for this project in particular, it became so personal to me, what I was learning, it really did. And so I felt like I was going to have someone else narrate the film. I had a great voice picked out for this one. And then as the more I wrestled with it, I was like, no, this has got to come from me. So I narrate the film, and I think that helps in just the feeling and the emotion that we could kind of bring to it. It was an immersive experience for me, and I wanted that to translate to the folks that watch it.
And so people who watch Unbroken Honor are going to hear your voice, and they're also going to hear the very distinctive voice of Lawson Sakai. Is there part of his story, or part of just spending the time you spent with him, that just is really at the forefront of your mind, how you remember him now that he's no longer with us?
That is a great question, because I only spent time with Lawson for 2 hours, just me and him in his home in Morgan Hill. That's it. I didn't talk with him on the phone a whole lot beforehand, and of course he passed away not long after we did the interview. And he struck me. I know you've spent time with him too, Paul, so you get what I'm talking about, but there's something about that man that was special. And so for me, one of the things I've thought about since the film's been finished, is that in a small way, I've kept his legacy alive. It's like he's going to be with us for a long time because of this film. And, you know, when people watch it, and it is sort of a spoiler alert, but you know, he was 97 when we filmed this in 2020, and he did pass away right after. But the way I do that in the film, it catches people by surprise at the end because you don't know that he's passed. And the way we handled it, I think, is very, very respectful to his whole story. His family has reached out to me since, and they're just so appreciative of the way we handled that part of the story. Lawson is someone that you'll never forget if you sit down and watch the film, and I never will. And even though I, like I said, only knew him for a couple hours, got to spend time with him for a couple hours. When I watch the film, it's like he's still there, and I like that.
Again, the film is called Unbroken Honor. You can find it on YouTube, and I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and also on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You're going to hear more from Jeff Aiello a little later, and I love what he said there about our late great friend Lawson Sakai. He's still there. His legacy lives on because of his courage and willingness to share his story throughout his final years with just about anybody who would listen. That's something we had the privilege of doing here on Hometown Heroes, and we're going to explore some of Lawson Sakai's story and learn more about this new film, Unbroken Honor, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where each week we remind you that freedom is not free by introducing you to some of the men and women who paid that price. And in the nearly two decades I've had the privilege of interviewing World War II veterans, I've had the chance to meet many others around our country contributing quality work in a like-minded pursuit. capturing that history so it can be communicated to younger and future generations as well. The new film Unbroken Honor represents another sterling example of that phenomenon, introducing new audiences to the incredible service and sacrifice of Americans of Japanese ancestry during World War II. And one thing I really appreciate about this documentary is that it chronicles not only the often-told heroics of the go-for-broke soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, but also the much less publicized contributions of those who served with the Military Intelligence Service, kept classified for decades, with many of the veterans' families having no idea what kind of impact they had on the Allied victory in World War II.
My father's response was, "Oh, didn't I ever tell you about that? I thought I told you that a long time ago." And I said, "No."
What Harold Fudena didn't share with his son for years is today considered a major turning point in the war in the Pacific. In April of 1943, the 5th Air Force requested Nisei MIS units to join the 138th Signal Radio Intercept Company at Seven Mile Strip on New Guinea. Not long after, Sergeant Fudena was on island, monitoring Japanese tactical frequencies on specialized radio equipment. On April 13th, Army and Navy intercept stations in Hawaii and the West Coast picked up Japanese chatter indicating that a high-level inspection of South Pacific forces would be happening soon and would be overseen by the commander of the Japanese Combined Fleet Command, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. Yamamoto was the architect and chief planner of the Pearl Harbor attack and one of Japan's greatest military minds.
The story of Admiral Yamamoto's fate and the code-breaking work that led to it is another element of World War II that we've explored on Hometown Heroes over the years with men who participated, and it is told very well in Unbroken Honor. The voice you heard at the end there is that of the filmmaker Jeff Aiello, who gathered supporters to get a first look at Unbroken Honor this past week in California's San Joaquin Valley, where so many Americans of Japanese ancestry were forced out of their homes and into camps 80 years ago. Among the crowd for that film premiere, World War II veterans Clarence Suzuki and Robert Uesaka. You got to premiere this film in front of a very special group of people that included two Nisei veterans of World War II, two Nisei veterans who we've heard here on Hometown Heroes. Were you a little nervous about them being in the room while you showed this hour that you've been working on for 3 years?
I was nervous whether they were there or not. It's the most nerve-wracking thing, and I said this to the group at Roger Rocca's when we premiered it last week. One of the most nerve-wracking things as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, an artist, whatever you want to call yourself, is revealing your creation to everyone besides your wife who's watched it be made and who helped it make it. It's very nerve-wracking. It's like, oh man, I really like this film. And a lot of my projects that I do, I'm not 100% in love with them, but they got to go. They have to go on the air. They got to get out. This one, I really loved when it was done. I loved it. I felt really satisfied, but I was really nervous to show it to everybody. And that's normal. To have Robert and Clarence there was an honor. I recognized them both. And I felt pretty good that they would feel like we did them proud, especially Clarence, who served in the Military Intelligence Service. You know, the 442 sort of gets all the spotlight from the Nisei soldier story point. And, you know, the Military Intelligence Service wasn't even really known to exist in the public until Nixon signed an executive order that declassified all of the World War II documents. And that's when its existence sort of became known. And so, you know, I was really glad that we could shine a light. It's kind of equal time. The MIS story we have is fantastic because I found the son of Harold Fudena, Sergeant Harold Fudena, who served in the Military Intelligence Service and was the guy who broke the code that revealed where Admiral Yamamoto was going to be on Bougainville in the Solomon Islands at a specific time. Yamamoto was notorious for being punctual, which was sort of his undoing, because the entire Operation Vengeance that was greenlit by Nimitz could and was built around the belief that when Yamamoto said he was going to land at Balalay Airfield at 9:30 in the morning, our guys could bet that was going to happen and plan that crazy mission with those P-38 Lightnings that flew 400 miles over the ocean, over the Coral Sea, 50 feet, max elevation, max altitude, zero radio. You know, it's just a crazy story. So that being able to tell all that is, it was fun. Clarence serving in the military intelligence service. I know I got to speak with him a little bit after the film, and they were both, they gave me that look. They might not be big on words, but I got the look from both of them. And I remember Robert specifically, his look. I got the nod and the look, so I felt good about that.
Again, that's filmmaker Jeff Aiello talking about Robert Uwasaka, a veteran of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and Clarence Suzuki, who served in the MIS. Both of those veterans have shared their unique experiences on Hometown Heroes before, and you can find their episodes at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as a two-episode conversation years ago with Lawson Sakai, who is featured so significantly in this new documentary, Unbroken Honor. His is a story I know I'll never get tired of hearing, and I hope you get a feel for the before and after of life interrupted, of just how jarring and transformational this chapter of our history is.
We were actually 7 miles from downtown Los Angeles City Hall. I walked it one time, and there was a lot of open land between where we were and downtown LA, not like it is today. But we had 5 acres, which, you know, it was a small greenhouse type flower industry, but it was in a nice location and easy to get to market. So my summers were spent on the farm. Growing up through the Depression years, of course, everybody had to do something because, you know, it was tough going in the late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, what do you remember about those times? And what about your family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one older sister. We really were a very small family. Most of the families, Japanese families, had 5, 6, 7, 8 children. They had big families, and their farms a little bigger. But in our case, we were very small, and I think it was sufficient. I used to help my father whatever I could. I was going to school, so I couldn't help him very much. But the whole Japanese community, and they used to get together for their own parties, but they couldn't associate with anybody else. Number one, they didn't speak the language, and number two, the other people didn't want the Japanese to mingle with them. But they were becoming the best and biggest farmers, best and biggest flower growers, the best and biggest fishermen. They had a huge fishing fleet at Terminal Island. My uncle was driving a Chrysler Airflow around, which was the car in, you know, 1938-9.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of business jealousies and so forth, and a lot of pressure on the politicians to remove the Japanese, which was the talk, was send them to Japan, you know, after Pearl Harbor, you know, ship them all to Japan, whether they're American citizens or not. That, you know, so then they possibly could have if they wanted to, I'm sure. You know, they put 120,000 into camps.
Yeah.
It wouldn't take much more to start putting them on ships and sending them out. So that was kind of the rumor going around. But
even before Pearl Harbor, I'm interested in your experience, because clearly that was a differentiating point. But I understand you were a pretty good athlete. You played high school football and basketball, even some in junior college?
It was war years. I weighed 140 pounds.
Yeah.
I played a running guard at Compton Junior College. I graduated high school in 1941. Mm-hmm. So in September, I went to Compton Junior College, and the ranks were depleted, let's say. So I got to play second string football. Mm-hmm. And I also played baseball later before I left California. But
had you ever faced any kind of discrimination in school, being Japanese American?
Very little. Nothing really to speak of, because the teachers were good. Almost all of my friends, the students, were all good. When I went, of course, I knew almost everybody at Montebello High School. When I went to Compton, I knew maybe one other person, maybe two. I didn't know anybody else. They're all strangers, but we all got along fine. Mm-hmm. Really had a good time there. The coach, Ed Suggett, used to kid me a lot. He said, when Japan attacks California, he says, are you going to attack me?
But I imagine that
December 7th really changed your life. That's probably a pretty memorable day.
It didn't affect me as a student. The other students didn't say, what the hell's going on or anything. But, you know, it just, I don't think it affected them as students, and they never passed it on to me. I got along fine before and after Pearl Harbor. The only thing, of course, the newspapers, radio, and so forth, it's really gearing up for getting worse and worse every day.
And that day, specifically for you, December 7th, 1941, I like to ask every veteran this, Japanese American or otherwise, because they all seem to remember something. And do you remember that moment when you found out?
It was Sunday morning. I was doing homework. I was listening to my radio when the announcer broke in and said Pearl Harbor had been attacked. I didn't pay much attention to it because I really didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. Then as the news report kept coming on, it was like they would break in every 15 minutes or so and give you more information. Then, you know, it described how the battleships were being sunk and so forth. It was a pretty big deal. And then I realized how serious it really was. So it was kind of tough talking to my parents. They were working when they came in for lunch. You know, it was kind of, I broke the news to them and they were pretty shocked. They knew it was going to happen. Everything was pointing toward some kind of a confrontation. So I don't think they were surprised, but they were pretty disappointed that it did happen, because then now it's what's going to happen to us. You know, that was the thing. And then, of course, that afternoon, the FBI shows up and, you know, they take my uncle away. So,
and I want everyone to hear that, because I don't think people realize, especially people that weren't alive, this is really hard for them to fathom. The very day that Pearl Harbor happens, the FBI shows up and takes your uncle.
They took a lot of people on December 7th. They knew where everybody was.
And why do you feel that your uncle was targeted, that he was snatched
He was
up?
The leader of the United Farmers Association, UFA, the largest produce market, 9th Street Market in L.A., a big wheeler dealer. So, you know, when they take the head, that leaves the rest of the body lifeless. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were doing. They were picking up whoever, teachers, lawyers, doctors, businessmen, anybody that they considered a leader of the community. They hauled them away, and that usually left people underneath who really were kind of helpless, and families, in most cases, the men in those days did everything. Mm-hmm. The mother just raised the family and helpless. Mm-hmm. This is what happened. All this kind of crippled the Japanese families. So it made it easy for the U.S. government to take the next step, which was putting everybody into the American concentration camps that were being built at the same time.
It's time for our final break, but we'll hear more of Lawson Sakai's journey and more about this new film that tells his story and the collective story of our Nisei veterans. Again, it's Unbroken Honor. You can find it online right now, and Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, shining a spotlight today on the new documentary film Unbroken Honor, which you can watch on YouTube right now. It's an hour and 10 minutes long, and it is well worth your time, even if you'd call yourself an expert on the Japanese internment and the exploits of Nisei veterans of World War II. Let's listen to another short clip from the film to give you an idea of what I'm talking about.
For many of the Japanese Americans now confined in these prisons, going along with Executive Order 9066 peacefully and willingly was a show of loyalty to their country and the American war effort. However, some of the young men would launch campaigns of consciousness against the stripping of their constitutional rights, while thousands of others would go on later to serve their country and eventually die in places like this forest in eastern France that for a short time became a battlefield to prove their love and loyalty to America, to ensure a better life and a restoration of freedom for their families they left behind. This is the story of the young men who fought for a country that had turned its back on them. The Nisei warriors of World War II. Men that proved with their hearts, their minds, their bodies, and their blood what it inherently means to be an American.
We're going to get one final thought from the filmmaker, Jeff Aiello, before we're done. I want to know what he wants all of us to get out of watching this documentary. But before that, let's dive back into Lawson Sakai's story. He was one of the more than 800 casualties suffered in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team's legendary rescue of the Lost Battalion, liberating a little more than 200 mostly Anglo soldiers who had been surrounded by German forces in those very same mountain forests that you'll see if you watch Unbroken Honor.
The weather was so bad, and of course we didn't have winter clothing, and we're soaking wet from the rain, and the hills were muddy. We're in the Vosges Mountains, the thickest forest that we'd ever been in. The Germans had the 88-millimeter anti-aircraft weapon, lowered it down, and started shooting it at the infantry. That sound of that 88 going off and exploding, that shrill sound coming is something that I've never heard duplicated in movies or anything. It's just mind-shattering. You know, when it comes directly at you, wow, you know, it just, the sound itself is enough to blow you apart. But when it would hit these trees, branches would come off. Sometimes half of a tree would come falling, weighing maybe 1,000 pounds. A lot of guys got crushed. And the morning that I got hit, the 28th of October, we're going to mount a real strong attack at daybreak. And the Germans probably sensed that we were, because we had a big battle on the 27th. We gained the high ground. We dug in as best we could. That early that morning, the barrage came in, probably lasted 20, 25 minutes, maybe more. I don't know. Maybe 100 rounds, just bang, 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 just continuously. We were pinned down. You couldn't move. We had a lot of casualties right at that time. And, of course, when I got it, well, I thought I was dead. So I was out of it. But
I imagine you had probably had some close calls before that.
Yeah, I got wounded twice in Italy and then once before in France. But they weren't that bad, you know.
Well, define that, because you say, yeah, I got wounded once. Well, yeah, and most people have never been wounded, period. So when you say weren't that bad, what do you mean?
You know, I got patched up and I could go back a day or two. Mm-hmm. The last time, the shrapnel that got me in, if it came straight through, it would have blown a hole through me, but it came in at an angle, so it wrapped around in my ribs here. Oh, that was really painful. It just, you know, a red hot piece of steel in there, and it just, your body just gives way. You just curl up and you can't breathe. And I was sure I was dead. I remember I told the medic, just let me die right there. And he pumped me full of morphine, because when I woke up, I was on a train
on a litter. They were going to the American Hospital in Dijon, which is not too far away, for surgery. And I don't know how I survived that one. But guys were getting killed left and right. You know, mostly the barrage from the artillery, just an awful shattering of not only the artillery shell, but the tree trunks and limbs coming down. In Italy, we had a few vineyards, a few olive orchards. Most of the hills were bare. Got to France and eastern France, and all of a sudden, this huge forest that we had to go through. The Germans were already entrenched, dug in, so we had to go into the forest, dig them out.
You're going into a meat grinder.
Yeah.
What about your recovery? How long did it take to recover from those wounds?
About 3 months, but not too long after October 30, when the 211 men were rescued, Dahlquist pushed the 442nd for another 4 or 5 days before he let them come off the line.
Right.
We had so few men left. I think I Company had 8 out of 250 or so.
8 out of 250.
Yeah. I think our company, E Company, had probably the most. From what I heard, we had about 40 men left. But the 442nd really couldn't do much in it. They just depleted. So they were sent to southern France between Italy and France, and a hillside where, like the Maginot Line, they had fortresses built. And the duty was to guard the French-Italian border and the port cities of Cannes, Nice, and that area, patrol all of that. They called it the Champagne Campaign because there was very little battle going on. But there was a few. One of my friends, Sakamoto from the Valley, he got killed there. I think he's about the only one that was killed during that time. Mm-hmm. And the 442nd was there like from the middle of November till April. And that's a time when all these young kids, now the Army changed the designation back to 1A because of what the 442nd was doing. Mm-hmm. So they made them all eligible for the draft and were being drafted. And they were being trained at Camp Shelby. So after about 6 months, they were sent over, and they came in en masse to fill up the 442nd again.
Right. It needed a lot of filling up because of how devastated it was. With those 3 months of recovery for you, were there ever days where you weren't sure you were going to make it? Or you weren't sure you were going to be yourself again?
No, I was in good shape after the surgery. A little painful, of course. But
did you have broken ribs?
Nothing broke. It just... a lot of muscle tear, which is pretty bad.
And there are a lot of internal organs inside your rib cage. I mean, there's a lot of damage that could have been done there.
It didn't go in. It didn't come through. It went around. Mm-hmm. So it just luck.
The angle was everything.
Yeah, just luck.
Was it luck or was somebody looking out for you?
I don't know. You see guys that... they get hit square in the head with a bullet. Oh, jeez.
Well, here's the other thing that strikes me. Your injury, which almost killed you. I mean, we're talking inches probably from killing you. But had you not been wounded that day, 442 has a couple more days of combat before they liberate the Lost Battalion, and a lot more guys died in those two
days.
That's
right.
Is it possible that getting wounded when you did could have saved your life?
Very, very likely. From what some of the guys told me, the day that I got hit, after the barrage, they made their way forward, but they had a tough time. That was the 29th, 28th, the next day is the 29th. They could hear firepower, but it was not coming at them. So they knew that must be where the Americans were trapped because the Germans were shooting at them.
And one of those Americans in the Lost Battalion, part of the 36th Infantry Division's 141st Regiment, was a man who later on would become close friends with Lawson Sakai, Al Tortolano.
Oh, I don't know. It was almost like being reborn, I think, because you don't know what to think. You know, while you're there and the way things are going, your mind is first on your family. You know, will I ever see them again? What will happen? How will they take it, you know, knowing that we're never going to, I'm never going to come back. And it was just, I don't know, the feeling that we had. But then when we found out that they finally broke through, oh, man, it was like the sun coming out after a storm, you know. You figure it was 7 days of what we went through. It was really hell up there because we couldn't really dig in deep because it was mountain, you know, and there was a lot of rock and stuff. You couldn't really dig a foxhole. And even if you did, the tree bursts, you had to worry about tree bursts, you know. When all of a sudden we heard one guy say, oh, my God, we're fighting the Japs. Because we didn't even know at the time that there was a 442nd. Mm-hmm. And yet they were attached to our division at times. Mm-hmm. But we didn't even know. And that's why that's one guy that made that remark. When we saw Japanese soldiers who were fighting the Japs. But then we found out they're our rescuers. And all we wanted to do was get out of there. And so we took off. I mean, we didn't stop to say thank you then or anything. All we wanted to do was get our butts off that mountain.
And I'm sure it wasn't until later that you realized the severe losses that they absorbed. They lost more men than they saved in terms of rescuing you. When you figured that out, how did that weigh on you? How did you process that, knowing that many men had sacrificed their lives for yours?
When I finally got to the, you know, thinking, really thinking about it, I know when they first rescued us, I was so happy and thankful. And then when we found out we didn't know until way later how many they actually lost. And I thought about it, I felt so bad because I said, here's a group of people that were used during the war. I don't know how to put it, but it seemed like when any dirty job had to be done or any fighting that they feel was almost impossible, the 442nd was always involved. Then I find out what their parents went through. And for them to volunteer to fight for their country like they did, I didn't know how to think about it. I just grab them and want to hug them, you know, and show them how you really felt about them.
You talk about wanting to hug them. I'm sure you've had the opportunity to meet some of the soldiers from the 442nd. What is that like for you? And is there anything that needs to be said? Is it a look in your eye, a hug, a pat on the back? Or have you had a chance to actually speak to them how much you appreciated them saving your life?
Oh, yes, I sure did. For about 8 years, I've been a volunteer up at the VA hospital in Palo Alto. Well, one day I'm driving the little shuttle around, and this Japanese-American, Lawson Sakai, says, are you Al Tortolano? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm Lawson Sakai. He says, somebody told me that you were driving. He said, I was with the 442nd. Oh, my God. He says, is there any chance we can get together and talk? I says, oh, yeah, yeah. So anyway, we started talking, and that's how I started getting involved with the 442nd. From there, they started inviting me to their different functions. I went to their reunions in Las Vegas as their guest. They made me an honorary member of the 442nd. And we got to swap stories, and I got to meet so many wonderful people.
And what does that do for you when you get a chance to talk to them and thank them? Do you feel like you're just speaking for yourself, or do you feel like you're speaking for all 220 guys who were saved by their brave actions?
Oh, no, I'm speaking for everybody. Yeah, because I know how they felt, not only speaking for those 220, I think I'm speaking for every other soldier that was in combat over there, thinking, man, if every division had a 442nd, what a great thing that would be. It would have been for everybody. Every time I see one, I don't care if I saw him yesterday and I see him again today, it's like another new beginning, you know. I look at him and say, wow, this is one of the guys that the reason I'm maybe standing here today. Maybe we would have gotten out of it. We never know. But as far as I'm concerned, they were our saviors. And they deserve every little hello or thank you that they can get.
And in 2011, they received another big thank you. All Nisei veterans of World War II were honored with the Congressional Gold Medal, the complete opposite end of the spectrum from the way Americans of Japanese ancestry were treated 70 years earlier. Let's get a piece of perspective today from the Purple Heart and Bronze Star recipient we heard from earlier, Lawson Sakai.
Well, you know, the whole country is formed by immigrants. So it's pretty hard to say one group of immigrants can say we're American, but you immigrants are not Americans. It, you know, that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that correction was a huge step in forming the United States. It's just something that had to be recognized. And in 1941, this whole country was run by the East Coast people. And a lot of those people, including President Roosevelt, had very little knowledge or contact with Asian people at that point, because almost all of us were on the West Coast, and East Coasters didn't want to mingle with the savages on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, it was like, oh, those animals out in the West Coast, you know. So I think the war did bring both sides together. East went west, west went east, and things changed a lot. I think we did what we intended to do. I'm sorry that, like my parents and all the other Issei who are now all gone, didn't really live long enough to capitalize on what we had gotten for them. 1952, I believe, they were allowed to become naturalized citizens of the United States. You know, a huge turnaround from deportation to naturalization, you know, and all because of what their children, the Nisei boys, did for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is very important to impress on, like, my children and their children, that they know that that first generation that was born here suffered along with their parents because they couldn't get jobs either. But by doing what they did, going to war and so forth, they, you know, they created the life for them that's so good.
Yeah.
Like, I have four children. They all graduated college. They're all doing good. I have seven grandchildren. They've all graduated college, and they're all doing good. You know, you couldn't have done that in 1941.
Well, none of them would have been born if you didn't survive the war. But, you know, I always end the show by saying freedom isn't free. And what you're saying is, for Japanese Americans, freedom and opportunity isn't free, that a lot of lives paid for it in World War II.
Absolutely. Well, we've had a couple of generations since that have never had to go to war. And in 1941 and 2, the whole world was at war. We were either going to win or lose. And if we lost, we'd either be speaking German or Japanese.
The one and only Lawson Sakai, featured prominently in the new documentary Unbroken Honor. And to put the finishing touches on this episode, I want to go back to the leader of the team that produced this film, Jeff Aiello.
The biggest question, and maybe the toughest question for a filmmaker, is what do you hope people get out of this? What do you hope the impact of this film is as people digest it?
For me, the big takeaway that I hope people have with this film is that there's a couple of things, but they're all sort of related. One is we're all the same. Japanese, Russian, Chinese, Italian, French, whatever, wherever we come from. And you learn this when you travel the world a lot. And I get to travel the world a lot. And I say it in the open of my travel show. When you travel, the world becomes a smaller place. The reason I say that is because you realize we're all the same. We're all very similar. We all want the same things. And so to go back and look at the lessons of, that we learned from hate, in specifically Asian, you know, hate, both the Chinese and Japanese, prior to World War II, and what that led to, I hope that we remember this story because it showed what happens when a population is prejudiced against one race or another, one ethnicity or another. Those Japanese Nisei and Issei were put into these camps, stripped of their civil liberties, no due process, and yet they persevered with that quiet resilience, gaman, as it's known. And then when we asked them to go fight for us, they had every reason in the world to say, pound sand, Uncle Sam. And they said, nope. And they signed up twice as many as we thought would sign up. And so I hope people that are judgmental towards other races remember that story. Because these, I said it the other night, yes, they're Japanese Americans, but they're Americans. And that's all they wanted to be looked at as. So I hope the takeaway from that is patriotism comes in all forms. It's not just white people that are patriots. and there's patriots that are Americans from all backgrounds, races, ethnicities, religions, doesn't matter. And just remember that and be kinder to people. Be kinder to one another. That's all I hope people take away from this.
What a fitting way to wrap up today's edition of Hometown Heroes. Thanks again to Jeff Aiello and everybody who made this new documentary, Unbroken Honor, possible. Find it right now on YouTube or follow the links at hometownheroesradio.com. That is all the time we have today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you one more time that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.